It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the Marquette Law School poll is updating the way it conducts its political surveys, and they're not alone as pollsters around the country make big changes. We'll talk to the Marquette poll director about the state of political polling in 2023. First, researchers announced two major discoveries last week in the world of physics, and Wisconsin scientists were at the center of both. We'll talk to two of those scientists about what they observed, starting with gravitational waves. After gathering more than 15 years' worth of data, scientists at the North American Nanohertz Observatory for Gravitational Waves, or NanoGrav, announced new evidence of low-frequency gravitational waves that ripple through the fabric of space and time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Now, have you been following this story since it came out in the news? Is there something you're curious about, confused about as to what this all means? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Vigeland is an assistant professor of physics at UW-Milwaukee. She's also chair of the Gravitational Wave Detection Working Group at NanoGrav. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with the basics. What are gravitational waves?
Gravitational waves are ripples in space and time that are produced when massive things move. Now, you and I are much too small to create gravitational waves that could be observed using any means that we know of. But gravitational waves are produced by really, really massive things like black holes. And that's really useful for astronomers because black holes, well, they're black. They don't emit light, so they're hard to see using conventional telescopes. But when they move, they give off these ripples. And by observing them, you can use those waves to figure out things about the sources that generated them. Things like how far away are they, how massive are they, how fast are they moving.
The thing I have a hard time wrapping my head around is what exactly is waving? And I think it's space itself. What's going on?
That's exactly it. So if you think about, so in general relativity, massive objects deform space and time, they warp it. And then if that massive object moves, the way that space is deformed has to change. And the information about that change is kind of spreading out throughout the universe, okay, in the form of these gravitational waves.
Now, talk us through how NanoGrav detected these particular gravitational waves. This is not something we can detect with the naked eye or anything like that. What went into this?
Right. So we've basically created a galaxy scale gravitational wave detector. And it's because the galaxy is filled with these special kinds of stars called pulsars. And pulsars act like clocks, just sitting out in space, ticking away. And that makes them ideal for measuring changes in space and time. Okay. So we monitor these pulsars. And by monitoring them, we can detect very tiny changes in space and time, which are produced by gravitational waves. So in essence, we have a gravitational wave detector that's spread throughout our galaxy. And then we use that to see gravitational waves coming from distant galaxies, coming from, for example, two black holes orbiting one another in a distant galaxy.
We've seen some past discoveries of gravitational waves, higher frequency ones. Can you tell us what those were versus what's involved in this new discovery, these lower frequency waves?
Sure. So the first gravitational wave detections was made in 2015 by the LIGO experiments. They use lasers to detect high frequency gravitational waves. So those are gravitational waves created by things that are changing on timescales of seconds. Okay, so in the case of LIGO, they detected two black holes about the same mass as our sun crashing into each other. So this is a kind of sudden event where space-time is changing very suddenly, but then it's over after the collision, after the merger happens. Okay, what we're seeing is a completely different type of source. We're seeing, what we think we're seeing is coming from two supermassive black hole. So black holes, millions or billions of times the mass of our sun, orbiting one another, and they're orbiting relatively slowly. They're orbiting maybe once every 10 years, 50 years, something like that. And so space-time is changing, but on very long time scales. Because of that, LIGO can't see the gravitational waves that we see. And conversely, we can't see the kind that they see. Their experiments are really very complementary in the same way that optical telescopes and radio telescopes are complementary. They both look at light, but they look at different kinds of light.
Talking to Sarah Vigeland, physicist at UW-Milwaukee, chair of the Gravitational Wave Detection Working Group at NanoGrav. You may have heard about a couple big physics discoveries last week. This is one of them, these low-frequency gravitational waves. Sarah, now you've found these low-frequency waves. In turn, what does that start to tell us about, I guess not just our galaxy, but about the universe?
Well, this is really exciting for us. We're just at the beginning of this story. We are just starting to see evidence of gravitational waves, but there's still a lot of questions that we have about, you know, the nature of this signal and what kind of source is producing it. So I mentioned supermassive black holes, but that's just one theory for what could be producing them. There are lots of other theories. That's part of why we're doing this experiment. That's why we're making these measurements, so that we can learn what actually is out there emitting these low frequency gravitational waves. A lot of these sources that we're excited about are things that either we can't see through electromagnetic observations, or, you know, we can, but it's difficult. And if we are able to use gravitational waves and electromagnetic observations, that will give us even more information.
You mentioned general relativity earlier, one of Einstein's, one of his big ideas. How does this discovery and the previous discovery of gravitational waves fit into confirming what he had proven, I guess, mathematically, 100 plus years ago?
Gravitational waves are a really important prediction of general relativity. So just the fact that we're able to observe them directly is an important test. But they also let us study gravity itself in a lot of detail. So gravitational waves in general relativity have two polarizations. You know, you might be familiar with the idea that light is polarized, like you might have polarized sunglasses that let through some of the light, but they block other light. Gravitational waves also come in two polarizations in general relativity, but in other theories of gravity, there might be extra polarizations. So that's a really important test that we can do with these gravitational wave detectors. We can go out and look and see if there is any evidence of extra polarizations. If there is, that would be a groundbreaking discovery. If not, that lets us put limits on how far away the theory of gravity can be from general relativity.
100 years in the making in some ways, 15 years of data collection led to this point for NanoGrav. What comes next?
A lot more. We have a lot of other gravitational wave searches we want to do with this data set. I mean, this data set, we've already done a lot of analyses on it, but we have even more to do searching for different types of gravitational wave sources. And the thing that I'm most excited about is working with our international collaborators. So at the same time, we had gravitational wave results published by the European Pulsar Timing Array, the Indian Pulsar Timing Array, the Parkes Pulsar Timing Array, and the Chinese Pulsar Timing Array. And NanoGrav and its international collaborators are going to be creating a combined data set where we take all of our data and make one giant data set, and then we're going to search that for gravitational waves. That will allow us to get even better measurements of this signal.
What's been the most exciting part of this process for you?
It's just incredibly exciting to be doing something that's never been done before, really on the frontier of science, you know, opening this new window on the universe. I'm really excited to see what we actually find.
Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
Thank you.
Sarah Vigeland is an assistant professor of physics at UW-Milwaukee. She's chair of the Gravitational Wave Detection Working Group at NanoGrav. She joined us to talk about NanoGrav's recent announcement about low-frequency gravitational waves that ripple through, you know, the fabric of space. Up next, we'll be hearing from another Wisconsin scientist about another big discovery, this one from our own Milky Way galaxy. That's coming up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation on recent discoveries in physics. Last week, scientists at UW-Madison's Ice Cube Neutrino Observatory announced they detected subatomic ghost particles coming from within our own galaxy. A Wisconsin physicist joins us now for a look at that discovery, what it means for the future of astrophysics. You could join in if you've been following the progress of Ice Cube and the search for neutrinos at 800-642-1234. Join in with your questions. That's 800-642-1234. Jim Madsen is interim director of the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at UW-Madison. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks, Rob.
Let's start again with the basics here. Neutrinos, what are they?
Yeah, so neutrinos are fundamental particles, which means they don't have any inner bits, and they are produced when other particles change identities. So it could be, for example, radioactive decay.
And I mentioned they're sometimes called ghost particles. These are hard to find. Can you talk about the challenge of detecting neutrinos in the first place?
Yeah, so it's one of these strange things where the issue isn't that there's not enough of them. It's the issue is that they're essentially invisible. So they go streaming right through easier than light can go through glass. So you have to be very clever and build giant detectors in order to catch a few of them.
And that takes us to Ice Cube in Antarctica. Can you tell us how you hunt for neutrinos down there?
Yeah, so what we need is a large chunk of clear material, and that's both to have something for the neutrino to bump into, and then once it bumps into that, to create other particles that are visible. And so the first people who tried to do this were working in water, either deep in oceans or seas or in Lake Baikal in Russia. But in 1987, Francis Hollison got the idea, maybe you could put light sensors down in the ice and that would work even better. And so surprisingly, it turned out to be right. And we're the only detector that's big enough to explore space in this way.
That takes us to the new announcement. Now, I've talked to people from Ice Cube before about detecting neutrinos, long-distance neutrinos from outside our galaxy. Well, here we are. The call is coming from inside the Milky Way. What did we find here?
Yeah, so the kind of unexpected thing from when we first came up with the idea to build this is that we wouldn't see our galaxy as one of the first objects because it's the closest, right? And so what we've did is come up with a clever way to sort out all the competing signals we are seeing in order to make our neighborhood visible. So kind of like, trying to mask out sounds when you're at a party so that you can hear the person that's standing next to you talking.
And when we're talking about neutrinos, now, of course, when we think of light, it travels at the speed of light. So we know how long it takes to get from point A to point B. How fast are these neutrinos going?
Yeah, so these neutrinos are essentially going at the speed of light. They have a small amount of mass, so they can't quite get to exactly the speed of light, but they have such high energy that to a good approximation saying that they are going at the speed of light is pretty close.
Now, when
in a race, they would lose, but just by a small amount of light.
When you detect neutrinos, whether from Milky Way galaxy or beyond, what is creating them? What are the things out there that are setting them shooting our way?
So that's kind of the neat part of the story is that's our next question we want to answer. And amazingly, even though we've been studying the galaxy with many different types of telescopes, the very high energy aspects of it are still unknown. So I wish I could tell you that answer, but you know, one likely type of source would be left over from a star exploding, like which is called a supernova remnant. So, but the amazing thing is we still don't know.
We're talking to Jim Madsen, interim director of the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at UW-Madison, looking at their recent discovery, neutrinos. They've spotted those before in this research station in Antarctica. Now they're finding them within our own Milky Way galaxy. Jim, are we at a point where we could say the Milky Way galaxy produces fewer neutrinos than its sister and brother galaxies out there in the universe?
Yeah. Francis Halsland likes to say it's a neutrino desert. So it turns out it's not as prolific as the other galaxies. And that's one of the intriguing questions. Why? What makes it different? And that tells us something about either the types of sources that are in our galaxy or maybe about the environment around the central black hole in our galaxy. There's something that's fundamentally different that makes it produce fewer neutrinos than, say, this one that we discovered last fall. That's millions of light years away, but easier to find than our own neighborhood.
What you've started to touch on this a little bit already. What are we hoping to learn now by studying neutrinos and those from Milky Way, the Milky Way galaxy, versus those from elsewhere? What are some of the questions you're hoping to start answering?
Yeah, so the amazing thing is nature has figured out a way to accelerate particles to a billion times more energy than the best laboratories we've built on Earth. And we have no idea how that happens, or even aside from a few places that we've discovered now with IceCube, where that's happening. So one of the things we want to do is understand that, and that may open up totally new ideas of physics. And then what's neat about IceCube is it actually has multiple things it studies at the same time. So the neutrinos themselves are still not well understood, and they do amazing things, like they have three types of neutrinos, and they can be created as one type but show up as another. And so the only particles we know that can do that. So we're trying to understand not only these amazing sources out in space, but also the properties of this neutrinos that tell us about those objects.
I want to talk about the challenges of doing this kind of work, right? Detecting these incredibly difficult to detect particles, and maintaining a research station basically at the South Pole, right, deep into Antarctica. What are some of the challenges of doing high-tech research in this incredibly remote and inhospitable location?
Yeah, it's, you know, so it starts with good design of the experiment. You know, so all the instruments that were put down on the ice have to function flawlessly in order for the experiment to work, and they have to keep working. And so the neat thing is some of these detectors now have been in the ice for close to 20 years and still, as Francis says, tick like a Swiss watch. And so the other big challenge is the station is only open for about 3 months of the year. So we actually hire two people each year to spend 13 months at the South Pole.
Wow.
If something does break on the surface, like, for example, once in a while, one of the computer hard drives will crash or something like that, they can repair that. But the good news is that it's mostly super robust and working extremely well. The facility is collecting data at 99.5% of the time. So it's been a tremendous success.
Back to neutrinos themselves, as I understand it, I mean, we're constantly, right, awash with neutrinos. There are lots of them, I don't know, probably passing through me right now without any indication that they've been there. Do I have that right when it comes to their abundance and the way they don't interact with most of what they go through?
Yeah, that's right. One of the crazy facts that I like to tell people is you have 100 trillion neutrinos going through your body every second, and in your lifetime you might capture one. So if you had ideas of being a neutrino experiment, you're no good, right?
And just in our last few moments, Jim, what is next? What are some of the next questions you're hoping to answer with Ice Cube?
Yeah, so the next steps are to better understand where these neutrinos are being produced in our galaxy. So right now, if you've seen the images, that map's pretty fuzzy, but we have some ideas on how to sharpen that up. We have some other galaxies that we think we'll be able to resolve soon. And then, as I said, studying the fundamental properties of the neutrinos themselves is a big part of our mission now. So we're going to have insights into how these neutrinos change from one type to the other and what that tells us about the way the universe works.
Jim, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much, Rob.
That's Jim Madsen, Interim Director of the Wisconsin Ice Cube Particle Astrophysics Center at the UW-Madison. He talked to us about the subatomic ghost particles originating from within our own Milky Way galaxy. That discovery just announced last week. One of two stories we've talked about with Wisconsin researchers about fundamental properties of our universe. Some mind-blowing stuff. Coming up after the news, the director of the Marquette Law School poll joins us to share new changes to survey methodology with the hopes of generating better response, more representative data on issues and elections. You can join in with your questions about polling, why and how we do it, what's changed over the years. You can email right now, ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we take a look at just how significant learning loss has been for students in the wake of the pandemic. Now, the Marquette University Law School released its latest poll last week, which measured the political opinions of over 900 registered voters in Wisconsin. This was the 75th poll conducted by the law school, which started the survey back in 2012. But now the polling team is updating the way they conduct the poll to get a more reliable sample of the population, a better response rate, and hopefully more accurate results. We often talk to the director of the survey about the results of the surveys and what they tell us about state and national politics. Today we're going to talk about survey methodology itself and how his and other polls gather this important data and what's leading many pollsters to change their polling ways. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how polling works, how it's changed over the years? How do you think political polling could be improved? Have you ever been surveyed for your political opinions? What was that experience like? Or did you just let it ring? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy at Marquette University and director of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
Now, I'm glad you picked up when we got in touch with you, Charles, but I think part of the problem that people may be wondering about when it comes to polling is people don't answer their phones as much anymore. How has that affected your polling and polling around the country?
It's been a big effect in terms of the costs of doing polls. Back in 2012, when we started the Marquette poll, we could expect about a 7% total response rate. Now, that sounds low, and it is low compared to 30 years ago when we could get a 70% response rate. But as you said, people don't answer their phone the way they used to. What that means is we simply have to dial many more numbers in order to reach our 900 respondents or so. Response rates now range from 1 to 2%, with many of them closer to 1 than to 2. And that was a problem we ran into last fall in the heat of the campaign. Our response rates dropped off, not tremendously, but some. But it meant the sheer number of hours we had to have interviewers attempting phone calls. And to put it in perspective, less than 1% of calls are answered when we first call. We will call back if a number's unanswered. But even so, we still end up with a 1.5% or so response rate. This is true throughout the industry, and it's been a big change. We're addressing that by developing these new methods, which others in the industry are also using.
Before we dig into new methods, one concern people might have, I assume pollsters might have, is, you know, if with that small response rate, if one group, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, old or young, committed political observers versus not, if one of those groups is more prone to answer the phone and the other group is less prone, could that skew results? How have you and other pollsters, prior to taking on these new methods, tried to make sure that didn't happen?
Yeah, that's an issue that goes way back in time, not really a function of this new lower response rate. So, for example, people with higher education are more likely to answer the phone. Older people are more likely to answer. Try getting somebody under 30 on the phone, even if you're related to them. It's not the easiest thing to do. So those things have gotten a bit worse in recent years, but they've always been an element of telephone surveys. The way we address it is to use census data that tells us the number of people under 30, over 65, the number of people with a bachelor's degree or less than a bachelor's degree. We know that for the population of Wisconsin. And so if we have too few younger people, we can weight those people up so that the weighted sample is the proper percentage of under 30s. And for the older people that are so anxious to do the interview, we weight them down a bit. So they're the right percentage of 65 and over. That works pretty well, and it can be tested and sort of demonstrated that it works pretty well. But it is a concern, especially when some groups become much less willing to respond. That became more of an issue with people under 30 in the fall. We still got such people, but we didn't get as many as we were getting even a year or two ago.
Talking to Charles Franklin with Marquette University Law School poll, talking about changes in polling, how pollsters, he and others, are updating things, trying to make sure they reach who they want to reach. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about how polling works, what's changing, what isn't working. Join in at 800-642-1234. Okay, Charles, I want to lift up the hood and do a little before and after. Can you give us the broad strokes, what happened before these changes? What was the step-by-step on your poll? How you found your voters? What kind of voters you were looking for? And so on.
Sure. So the key thing is this is a random sample of registered voters in the state. You can't volunteer to do the poll. You can't sign up for it and do it five times. You have to be randomly selected. And that's the same in the old method and the new. In the old, we started with all the phone numbers in the state, both landline and cell phone, and we randomly picked the numbers to call, and that's how we generated our sample. And then we asked people if they were registered to vote or not. What we're doing now is starting with a list of all registered voters in the state. You buy that list from a company that takes the state's public registered voter list and then provides it to survey groups. But we also use a separate sample based on postal delivery addresses around the state with, again, a random sample of addresses that mail is delivered to. Those folks get a U.S. Postal Service letter inviting them to take part in surveys. So what we're doing now is blending these two. About 3/4 of the respondents come from the registered voter list, and about 1/4 come from this address-based list. Put those two together, and that's our sample. But in both cases, these are registered voters and they were sampled randomly.
Is doing a survey on the phone the only option under this new look, or are people doing this online in some cases?
Well, thankfully, it's not the only option anymore. That's one of the advantages of this shift. For the registered voter list and the address-based sample, we have email addresses for the substantial majority of people on those lists. So those folks now get an email inviting them to take part in the survey, explaining that it's Marquette doing the survey and how to participate. And it includes a unique link that can only be used once and only by the person that received the email. For the people that we don't have email for, we phone them. And so as a result, this time we did just a little over 2/3 of respondents who responded by email or online, I should say. They got the email and then they responded online for that roughly a little under a third that weren't reachable by email. We phoned them. Also, if you get an invitation to participate, we will phone you if we don't hear from you fairly soon.
All right. So what was the response rate like in this first spin of the new method?
Well, the grand total is about 1.5%, but the people that do the poll from the address-based sample respond at a higher rate. The phone calls to the registered voter list, as I say, is right there in the a little better than we were doing last fall, but it's still in the 1.5% range. The total combining those two is a little bit better than what we were getting last year. But the main thing is people really like being able to do the interview online. They can do it on a smartphone, or they can do it on a tablet or a laptop, or God forbid, a desktop computer. But mostly, I think they like us not calling during dinner time.
I like my desktop computer. We're talking to Marquette Law School poll director Charles Franklin about polling methodology, updates the ways he conducts his political opinion surveys. This is happening in polls around the country as well. And coming up, we'll talk a little bit about what we do with these polls, whether it's for a race for political office or measuring support or opposition for an issue over time. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of political polling? Do you follow a poll, lots of polling at election time or on key issues facing the nation? What questions do you have about how it works, what we can and can't do with it? Call in at 800-642-1234. We will answer the phone when you call. 800-642-1234 is the number to call, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy and director of the Marquette University Law School poll. He's with us today for a look at updates the way he conducts his survey and changes in political polling across the country. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about political polling? If you've participated in a survey, we'd love to hear about your experience. Join in with your questions, your experiences, your thoughts on the value of polling. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Heard from Cynthia, who couldn't stay on the line. Cynthia says she's one of those people that never answers the phone, suggests that hey, you ought to let people know what number to expect ahead of time so they know to answer. Too many spam calls, especially when you're retired. Charles, is that part of the new system here where people maybe know that number is coming?
No, and the number is just a number. It doesn't come up on caller ID as coming from Marquette. Our phone facility is contracted out and is out of state, actually, in Pennsylvania. With the email, though, we do get around that because now you get an email. It explains what's going on at some length, and as I said, says that this is the Marquette poll. So people do have a better ability to understand that rather than the unknown phone call. But as we all know, phone calls are really a problem these days, and lots of people are like Cynthia who don't answer. I wish I knew of a way around it. The way around it is to send an email to a registered voter list. Some companies are sending a letter in advance. Others are using text-to-web interviews where you get a text message and a link. We're not doing those last two yet, but they may someday be in our future as well.
Thanks for that call, Cynthia, at 800-642-1234. Charles, there's been, some skepticism, about polling starting in 2016 in particular, a sense that Trump voters were undercounted pretty consistently in polls at the state and national level. Are some of these changes, or other changes in polling around the country, reacting to that?
Yes, they are. And that biggest worry in polling is that certain types of voters choose not to respond. If it's highly educated or less educated, we know how to deal with those. The trouble is, what if a certain type of voter, somebody who supports Donald Trump and has particular characteristics, if they won't respond to us, it's very hard to know how to address that question. So one of the things we're doing is looking at the partisan balance in the survey much more closely and looking at that partisan balance within regions of the state. So that's one step to address it. We've also been looking at the response rate in each county in the state and whether that's related to the Trump vote in that county in the past, in 2020. Throughout 2022, I'm happy to say that we saw no correlation. Our response rates were about the same in the most pro-Trump counties as they were in the middle counties and as they were in the most anti-Trump counties. So at least by that measure, we're not seeing big biases. Having said all of that, it is a constant worry, and it's one that we'll be working on from now right through the 2024 election. The one advantage of using the registered voter list as opposed to calling phone numbers at random is we do know not how you ever voted in the past, but we do know how often people voted in the past. And so that should also help us with our likely voter model to be able to look at regular voters, occasional voters, and people who are registered but did not participate in 2020. For example, or 2022.
Let's go back to our callers. Jim is with us in Westport. Jim, hi.
Hi. My brother had done polling for years, so I always answer the phone and always try to participate. But one thing I notice is sometimes there may be half a dozen questions. Other times it seems like they go on and on and on and on and on. And the longer the questions are, or the more questions, I feel like I kind of lose interest and might not be a good person. Is there kind of a sweet spot if you ask half a dozen questions versus 12 where you feel you get better data?
Jim, thanks for the call. Charles, go ahead.
Yeah, that's a great question. It's a mixed bag. Some campaign polls will just ask 3, 4, 5 questions and that's it. They just want to get a quick hit and get off. For us, though, it's so expensive to get people on the phone in the first place, right? Those more than 100 calls that don't get answered. And so once we have you on the line, we want to get a variety of opinions. So we ask around 25 to 30 substantive questions, and then we ask a handful of demographic questions like age and education that we need. The result is our total length on a telephone call will be around 15 minutes. A few people go longer than that, but we try really hard not to go past 15. Interestingly, the people that fill out the survey online completed in something closer to 10 minutes. That may be faster reading speed. It may be the convenience of answering online. It could also just be that the online method flows more quickly. You don't get into a conversation with the interviewer, so you focus on answering the questions and finishing.
Jim, thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Charles Franklin with Marquette University Law School survey, looking at changes in polling in recent years, big changes in the newest poll from Marquette. Charles, I want to talk about the value of different types of polling. First of all, one thing you've done over the years is track Wisconsinites' opinions on a variety of issues. What, when we ask the same question again and again over the years, what kind of patterns, what kind of changes have stood out to you over the years?
Yeah, there are a few things that have changed quite a bit, but many things have either not changed at all, or they've changed in a very steady pattern over time. So, for example, back in 2012, when we started, support for concealed carry in Wisconsin was a little more unpopular than popular. But support for that has climbed up to in the mid-60s, who now support concealed carry. Support for same-sex marriage rose steadily over time. On the other hand, views of abortion have been quite flat over time. And one in this latest survey, concern about water quality, water safety in your community, and concern specifically about PFAS, the long-lasting chemical that we've seen in a number of communities around the state, concern for those things have gone up each year over the last several years. So you see that people are more concerned about that issue. That affects, obviously, the quality of your life and the quality of your drinking water.
With changes in methodology, can we say, okay, surveys after the change, we can compare them reasonably with surveys before the change?
Yeah, we're doing everything we can to make sure that's true. The most difficult part of it is on the telephone, somebody can simply say, well, I just don't know about that, or I haven't thought about that. And an interviewer will then record that person as having said, don't know. But when you're doing the survey online, the options that are presented on the screen are all you can choose from, or you can skip the question entirely. But not nearly as many people skip the question as volunteer that they don't know on the telephone. So one of the things we're looking at is how to calibrate those don't know responses over time. The good news is that's usually not a real big factor, but the bad news is it can matter in certain circumstances. And so we're working on that. I ran every question that we've ever asked before that we asked in June. And I'm happy to say that most of them showed really modest movement. And where we saw big movements, the big movements seemed to make sense substantively when you think about the current political environment. Having said all of that, we will be watching for when something looks like it's not consistent with past responses, and we'll either flag that in the poll release or otherwise make some adjustment for it.
And finally, Charles, when people think of polling, they might often think of the election race type polling, candidate A versus candidate B, say. You do that, of course, in your polls. We often, when you're on, get questions of, well, why? Why bother surveying people? The real survey is the election itself. What is the value of doing that kind of polling over time?
Yeah, well, the most important thing is that last I heard, the election won't be held until November of 2024. So do we want to sit around and not know anything about how people are making up their minds about the candidates until election day? I, of course, argue no. We want these snapshots in time of June and October and January and so on. You put enough snapshots together and you get a movie. You get to see how the election developed over time, who rose and who fell. And then at the very end, we get our report card. We get to see how well we did. Was our final poll close to the actual election result? And the good news is, on average, we have been within 2.2 points of the actual result. The bad news is, in 2016, we were off by 6 points. And that was disappointing, to say the least. So don't take any polling for granted, but on the same token, try to use it for that motion picture of where we are today, but over the long haul, how are we developing between now and election day?
Charles, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us.
Thanks so much. Always good to be with you.
That's Charles Franklin, professor of law and public policy at Marquette University, director there of the Marquette University Law School Poll. He's with us today to talk about changes in polling here in Wisconsin and around the country. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, most of Wisconsin is facing moderate to severe drought, according to the latest data. Find out what leads to droughts and the impact that has on farmers in the state. That's tomorrow morning at 8.